is ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland.
I always enjoy talking books with this man because he's just so passionate and so articulate about it and obviously very well read. Ron Sajuk is from Pulp Fiction Books and he's, as always, has an armful of new reads. G'day, Ron.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Where do you find the time?
Oh, you know, you build it in.
I mean, how does that work exactly? Tell me.
You don't watch a lot of TV. I find that I don't watch much TV now.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's just a mood, and you think, no, I really need to escape, and you just have to put the world aside and immerse yourself between the pages of a good book. And while you're doing it, it feels almost decadent. It's wonderful to have that time to yourself to do that and immerse yourself in something else, especially when the book's good and you get a good book buzz on and you just think, this is great. I love it.
So what's been exciting you lately?
Well, I've had four books for tonight that I got a good book buzz on all of them.
Okay.
And they're all really different too. Yeah. So, you know, last month, I think it was, we were talking about some new Australian books. There was Jane Harper's The Dry and Sarah Bailey's
Dark Lake, which I really want to read. You really talked up The Dry so much in particular.
There must
really
be something going on with Australian crime fiction. There's some fantastic books at the moment. So they were great. And there's another one, Mark Brandy's Wimmera.
Yeah, right.
And again, it's set in rural Australia, which often when I'd read books many over the years set in rural Australia, crime novels, whatever, I'd felt, I don't know, somehow they weren't authentic. They weren't my vision of what rural Australia was, you know. And last month's two books did it so well, even though they were in very different kind of towns. And this does it again too. And it's funny because if I say to you it's a literary novel or a literary crime novel thriller, what's your take on that? What would you expect it to be like?
Well, you probably say it's a little bit more weighty or more traditional, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not. It's actually, it's about the friendship and the consequences of some events that happen in a small country town to two young men who start as boys. It starts in the 1980s and then it comes back again in the 90s and then it comes back a bit later on. And you know, really it's the conversations of two sort of bordering on teenage adolescent boys, and you know, boys are pretty basic and it's pretty raw stuff and it's pretty dark, but it's extraordinary, and it's one of those novels. I mean, all of the reviews I've read, I keep saying it's powerful. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, it's true. I thought a lot about when I was reading it, authors like Ruth Rendell, the great British writer, and her, you know, exploring the darker sides of the human psyche. And there's a Scandi crime writer like Karen Fossum who does very similar things, where when she's going through what happens in a crime, although the book is ostensibly a police procedural with her two police characters, it's actually it becomes about the protagonists and the crime and people just making poor decisions and it almost happening out of control and things like that. It's really interesting, the backstory, and that's kind of what this is, I guess.
That's how you get caught up. So Mark Brandy, has he been a relatively new
author? Yeah. And in fact, this book's already, you know, getting awards overseas. So it won the British Crime Writers Debut Dagger for an unpublished manuscript. Now it's been published in the Victorian Premier's Award for an unpublished manuscript as well. And I was really taken with it. I think we're going to see a lot of him in future books. It's very much a standalone novel. I don't think we're going to see a sequel to this the way we will with Jane Harper's book or the Sarah Bailey perhaps. But it's fantastic. It's, you know, these two young guys working it out in rural Australia, and something pretty terrible happens, and it's pretty affecting, and it makes you think. And it's very much of today. It's a story behind the headlines that we've become so familiar with seeing.
Which gives it so much more realism.
Yeah, you know, and it just, you know, you're thinking as you read it, gosh, this story could be taken straight out of tomorrow's newspaper, you know. It's, yeah,
wow.
Very well done.
Okay.
And I think that you know, this is one that it's a challenge and it's dark and it's raw, but it's really good.
All right. Wimmera by Mark Brandy, an up-and-coming Australian author, certainly one to keep an eye on. Now, did you want to talk about Templar's Last Secret?
Yeah, okay. I do. So I almost felt this is like becoming an annual event. So we're going to do the armchair travel now as well as the armchair detective because we're going to go to France. We're going to go to the Dordogne.
Let's go.
Seriously, this is much cheaper than a plane ticket. And you avoid a whole lot of hassles with, you know, customs and long flights and queues. So Martin Walker's become such a favourite of ours now, and it's almost like with every book, he's getting a bigger readership. And he writes about a rural policeman in France in the Dordogne called Inspector Bruno. And Inspector Bruno is like the most noble and true and wonderful of French men. He's everything that you could, everything good you could imagine. He's too good to be true, really. He's lovely. He's just a great bloke. He's had a background in the military and a little bit of Secret Service stuff, but he's ended up sort of opting out of all of that and coming to this little town, the Saint-Denis. Yeah. And
again, we're in a provincial area.
Yeah. And I mean, and every time you read it, you just feel like you're breathing the air of, you know, the Dordogne. And there's a terrific quote in here. Someone says to him, remember, the first rule of policing is that make sure you have friends everywhere. And he has friends everywhere. And you get to know all of these people and recurring characters. So there's a few characters here from much earlier books in the series that come back. And you think, oh, there they are again. And it's like visiting old friends. You know, he's got a wonderful dog. He's got, you know, he rides horses. He's got this little farmlet outside of town. He just goes out into the garden and harvest stuff. There's a bucks party in this where, you know, admittedly it's a bucks party for, you know, eminent archaeologists who are all fairly middle-aged. But, I mean, boy, the French do it with style. It's not about going out and getting rabbited on lots of beer. You know, it's not like an Australian bucks party. I kept thinking, wow, compare and contrast. You know, I mean, it's rural France, and he organises to get a salmon sent in, and he, you know, picks baby asparagus from the garden, and it's served with melted butter sauce and, you know, new potatoes and roast salmon and salads and cheeses and everything kind of handmade and hand done and matched with local wines, and you just think, I want to be there now, you know, and you're
cheaper than a plane ticket,
but
nowhere near as much
fun. On a peanut butter sandwich wishing I was elsewhere. But it's there, look, it really is just a complete escape. And, you know, and you learn some stuff. So, you know, a woman is found at the bottom of a drop near a fantastic old medieval castle. And it's assumed it's an accident that she's fallen from this thing while trying to do graffiti a bit of wall. But then, is it? And of course, it turns out, no, it wasn't an accident. And there's a much more sinister story. And as in the previous book, this goes behind the scenes. There's stuff going on that ties in with current day headlines. You know, all three of the crime novels are very to the moment, and you know, you feel like they've got stuff in them that you're aware of, because this is stuff that's going on around us all the time.
But not in a way that you think would date them in 10 years or 20 years.
Look, I think it's going to be stuff that's pretty ongoing. sadly, it's the way of the world, you know. And I think what I really liked with this is there's a young woman who is sent in from Paris to spend some time with local rural police to try and look at the way they police in the country and what lessons can be learned. And you know, and of course, everyone's dreading this kind of like, oh, can you imagine head officers sending us someone who's going to do a time and motion study on us? It sounds like a nightmare. But of course, she's a good egg and she's a whiz with social media. So there's this whole thing of the, you know, the countryside coming alive as people are starting to kind of use social media to help trace things and
You're
do
right.
police. And,
okay.
and there's a lot of really interesting behind the scenes detail that you think, how clever. It's like stuff that rural fire brigades are doing to let people know when stuff's out. So, I mean, this policeman is able to sort of have a whole series of different networks, you know, to say, hey, we're looking for someone and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, you can put the tobacconists in a little network together and say, hey, if anyone comes in trying to buy cigarettes, we know they're a smoker, you know. Yeah. And so there's really clever ways of tracing people and doing stuff like that. I really liked it. I mean, it's not exactly a Bourne or a James Bondian thing, but it's still pretty clever. And there's a lot of great archaeological stuff because the area in France is right near the Lascaux cave paintings, and that becomes a big thing. There's lots to do with the treasures, the treasure, in inverted commas, of the Knights Templar, the great missing legendary thing, possibly the Holy Grail, you know, and you know, all sorts of stuff when a cave is found below the castle becomes relevant. And it's got some pretty exciting stuff in it. So, intriguing. Yeah, we love this series.
Okay, the Templar's Last Secret, Martin
Walker. Have you ever heard of a chabrol?
No, what's a chabrol?
Chabrol, I think, is it's this bizarre old Perigord custom where when you're finishing your soup and you're down to the dregs of the soup in the bowl, you slosh in a little bit of the wine that you're drinking, and then you pick the bowl up and having mixed it all around and drink the wine and the remains of the chabrol. Soup from the bowl, and that's the chabrol. And apparently there's an old expression about, have you had your chabrol, which is like, you know, are you full, are you, have you eaten yet, blah blah blah. And when this is introduced to some of the characters in this, they're like, oh, this is weird, and it's just like, ooh. But yeah, so anyway,
customs.
Yeah. Go slurp your wine into some soup.
Okay, so you mentioned that it's not a Bourne or a Bond, but you do want to talk about The Spy's Daughter.
Yeah, this is like a Bourne or a Bond. Okay. This is fantastic. I was really taken with this. Adam Brooks, probably a year and a half ago or whatever, I did a book on here called The Night Heron, which was turned out to be the first in a series featuring a couple of recurring characters. And he's decided that this, The Spy's Daughter, will be the last in that series. It's a trilogy. He wants to go and do other things. He's not going to just stretch it out interminably, you know, till the bitter end. Fantastic story. From the word go, there's a young Chinese-American girl living in Washington, D.C. Her name's Pearl Tao, and she's very special. She's a genius. There's stuff she's working on, advanced mathematical stuff in conjunction with universities, and her scholarship is being paid for by a big arms and military technology company. So we know she's working on some pretty amazing stuff. But, of course, what she doesn't realise is that she's a bit of a pawn in a big international game, and that her parents are, in fact, embedded Chinese spies. And espionage is the name of the game. And then we come back to two British secret agents who have erred in a previous novel and who we're familiar with and are now possibly the only people that can sort of get her out of this and save her. Boy, oh boy, it's a cracking yarn. And talk about travelling. I'm in awe of this man. Adam Brooks used to be a BBC journo and correspondent, and he's been to a lot of places, but holy cow, the places that they go to in this. I mean, you know, from Hong Kong and Macau and you know, mainland China, down throughout Indonesia, small islands there, West Papua, up to Africa, to the UK, to America. It's such a terrific jigsaw of a story, but, you know, it never lets down on the pace, and you're interested in all of the threads. And as it starts to come together, and again, it feels like it's something ripped from today's headlines. You know, when you look at all the money laundering and the industrial espionage and the stuff that's going on and the kleptocracies and funny little in Suriname, you know, for example, there's a, you know, a corrupt banker who is, you know, where all the money is being kept and things like that are happening. It's a fantastic yarn. I'd love to see it filmed one day. I can but hope it will turn up as a glossy, you know, kind of cable TV series or as a film. But I want to go back and reread the others now because I think this is just such a good yarn.
Okay, right. Yeah. So a bit like John Le Carre.
Yeah, he's up there. I think, you know, I personally, you know, is this bad? I'm not a huge fan of Le Carre. I used to find them a little bit long-winded and a little bit, you know, dry. But I love people like Philip Kerr and John Lawton, and they're probably my favourite contemporary sort of thriller spy crime writers. And he's up there with them. He's really good. Okay. I can't recommend these highly enough. I think they're fantastic.
All right.
And did you ever see there was an American TV series called The Americans? And
no of it.
Okay, yeah, it was on SBS. I don't know that it had
not
a complete.
Long ago.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that it had a complete run. It's into about three or four seasons in the US, I think, on cable channels, and it's a series based on real life incident that happened where, you know, some Russian sleeper agents were embedded in Washington for 20 or more years, where they were given American identities and lived out their lives as if they were just all American people, had kids, did this and that. And of course, it turned out that they were Soviet moles, sort of spies that were deeply, deeply embedded. And the TV series is fantastic. It's a real favorite. And this kind of had, you know, elements of that going on, because you've got this sort of embedding of you know, agents and you know, the espionage that goes on and stuff like that. It's just, yeah, a lot of fun.
All right, fantastic. The Spy's Daughter is the name of the book by Adam Brooks. You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane in Queensland. Ron Seduke is our reviewer and doing a stellar job as always. Going to move on to a bit of fantasy and science fiction, Ron?
Yeah, and this one really, it's a bit of a cheat actually, because I've gotten an advanced copy, so unfortunately, if you like what I say about it, you can't get it for about 6 weeks. I think it's not due out until late September, early October.
It must be good. You can't wait to talk about it. So that's
good. It's called Satellite by Nick Lake. And I guess in a way, if you wanted to give a pitch, you'd be saying it's kind of like that Sandra Bullock movie Gravity crossed with the Matt Damon film The Martian, and aimed at a young adult audience, because mainly because I think the protagonist in it, the major protagonist, is a young adult, and he's got a couple of young adult friends in it. There's a great tag on the front of the proof copy that's saying that Leo, the main character, is going to a place he's never been before, home. And he's never been to Earth because he was born on a satellite. There was, they're not specific about the date, but I consulted Google. And as they said, there were about 10 billion people, or just over 10 billion people on the planet, and resources were getting scarce. So I asked the question to my smartphone and said, you know, when will we have 10 billion people on Earth? And it came back and said, oh, at 2049, 2050, they're estimating, you know, 9.7 billion. So it's around the 2050-ish, sort of, you know, 30-something years from now. And there's a big international-style space station, and resources are getting scarce. There's, you know, planets are being found out there. You know, our astronomy skills are getting better and more honed, and they're finding hundreds of other planets. But, of course, getting to them is a long and perilous journey. It's a generational thing. And so they're needing to have some experiments, and one of those experiments is can babies be born on the space station successfully? Because as we know more, we realize just how hostile space is an environment. I remember growing up reading lots of Arthur C. Clarke and Asimov and Heinlein, and, you know, it was all can do, and we were going to get onto spaceships and do all this stuff, and it would become as routine as flying planes. No, you know, there's lots of really difficult things out there. You know, not having gravity is really contraindicated for the human physiology, you know. It really stuffs you around.
Yeah.
And so, and at some point, there were three babies born on this space station, and that in itself was a bit of a big deal. But they couldn't come back to Earth because they were born in zero gravity and it did things to them. And so they've had to kind of keep them running on treadmills and feed them specially and do all those things that they have to do to astronauts in space station to keep them healthy.
Yes.
And we're told that we won't bring you back to Earth until you're 16 because we don't want to risk damaging you as a child. And when you've sort of reached that level of maturity, you should be able to handle it. So it's basically the story of mainly Leo and his two friends and what happens to them on this space station. And of course, they do come back to Earth, and nothing is quite as it's thought. Nothing goes quite as it's planned. And it's one of those real tear in your eye sort of stories. It's beautifully done. And it's also, there's a few weird decisions too. Like, for a start, it was one of those books when I picked it up, I was quite shocked because you look at it and the typeface in the book, and I don't think this is just in the proof copy, I think it will be in the finished copy, is a sans serif. It's, you know, like a Helvetica style typeface, which is not something you'd typically want to read a long form piece of fiction in, because it's just not what we're used to. And there's lots of studies that have shown that it's not easy. It's not comfortable for the eye. Maybe it's starting to change because we're so used to texts and computer screens with sans serif typefaces, but I had no difficulty reading it. I ate it all up and I was thinking, wow, I didn't even really notice it very much. The other thing is that his style of writing is that he's using, I don't want to say text speak, that's been used in reviews. It's not completely text speak, but he does, for the word C, yeah, he just uses the letter C, and you know, and you, Y-O-U, becomes you, and there's a sort of a shorthand with certain things. He doesn't use capital letters except on proper nouns and some other names. And a lot of reviewers have freaked out about this. And I found it. And well, no, it's a thing. If it puts you out of the story, then it's valid, I guess. Yeah. But it didn't put me out of the story. And in spite of that text speak, which I thought would annoy me, it's beautifully written. There's some almost poetic, some lovely stuff in there. He really is a terrific writer. And you can see why he's been nominated for the American Carnegie Children's Book Award a couple of times.
Right.
He really knows his stuff. And I thought this was great. And it had, you know, elements of those kind of Hunger Games-ish children against the adults, or, you know, young adults against the adults, and you know, just a lot of smart technology, and it really goes through a lot of those problems that you encounter when you're in space and you are looking to go out there, and explains it in a way without it being, it's not a laborious info dump, it's just integrated into the story really, really well. And, yeah, really nice balanced list of characters who are really appealing and just really good. And, again, you know, makes you think about what the world's going to be like with 10 billion people on it. You know, if resources feel scarce now, wow.
Well, we have to wait 30 years. We'll find out. Ron Saduke, been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Friendly.
It's a great place.
Good weather.
You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland.
Queensland!
Woo! And we've still got that laid-back atmosphere.